Richard Rohr is a Franciscan priest and founding director of the Center for Action and Contemplation in the United States. His brief is a wide one, ranging from men's spirituality through to a role as a contributing editor and writer for the radical evangelical magazine Sojourners, founded by Jim Wallace, who's been an occasional guest here on Sunday Night. Richard Rohr, welcome to Sunday Night.
I'm very glad to be with you. Thank you.
Richard, the fact that a Franciscan priest can comfortably sit as a contributing editor to a magazine with its roots in evangelical Protestantism is a sign perhaps of just how far religious understanding has moved in the past 40 years.
That's a great observation. Now, in this case, it goes back to a personal friendship, though. Jim and I knew one another since we were young men. We were both pastors of lay communities. I in Cincinnati, Ohio. He originally in Detroit and then Washington, D.C. And we had so much in common as sort of these father figures of communities. And because we were both trying to deal with social issues, we found that our evangelical and Catholic background really didn't get in the way or interfere. It, in fact, supported. I took him to Assisi once, and he said, "Gosh, Richard, this could make a Catholic out of anybody." If you've ever been to Assisi.
Indeed, I have.
And, you know, I think because my great field has been Scripture, it always gave me a leaning and an appreciation of my Protestant brothers and sisters.
There is also something in I guess, your link there in a common community that was, on both sides, was concerned with faith and action. And that is something, of course, that is deeply connected to your Franciscan heritage.
That's right. That's right. See, Francis saw the gospel as primarily not a belief system, not that he was against belief, but he saw it as a lifestyle. He told us to preach the gospel at all times, and when absolutely necessary, use words. That it was not the communication of a packaged product that people either agreed with or disagreed with, but for Francis, the gospel was living a simple, humble, nonviolent life in this world. And
some
that
people,
was our way of being Jesus.
Some people have observed that one of the problems of the Protestant Reformation was the resultant shift in both Catholic and Protestant lifestyles to a focus on the word, on purity, on the intellect, and the whole idea of the lifestyle has been really hard to dredge back into focus.
I think that's well put. And, of course, the Protestant Reformation came at that time in history when the printing press was being invented. We were all moving into the left brain, words, ideas, concepts, and they both profited from that but also have suffered because of that. I think that's true.
In working with people like Jim Wallace and building bridges between faith communities, is there still a problem in some quarters in the church? And do they look at you and say, "Look, you know, you get a bit far out there"?
You know, I don't know if you're familiar with the term the emerging church. And it's understood in different ways by different people. If you'd Google emerging church, you'd probably get 10,000 entries. But in many ways, what's emerging is precisely this consciousness that people across denominational lines are finding again and again that we very often have more in common with one another than people inside of our own denomination. This is a new demographic. It's just mind-blowing. We had a conference in March in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where I live, and we had 1,000 people without even trying across the board denominationally on this whole idea of the emerging church. It's exactly what you're pointing to.
It becomes a very risky area, and you've been working in this for your whole of your priestly life, but this connection between faith and life takes you of necessity from the social to the political. They can't be disentangled. Many of those religious people, for example, who put their trust, say, in George W. Bush, have had their fingers burned. Similarly, someone like Barack Obama has made a public profession of an active faith. Is there not a risk here also?
Well, if it's a risk, it's a necessary one. I think once we see the gospel as lifestyle instead of merely an antiseptic belief system, then, as you already said, it necessarily moves into questions of economics, of what we call politics, how power is used and misused. When I see how Jesus' teaching is undercutting power and revealing the dark side of misuse of dominative power, I don't see how you can avoid going there yourself. Or if you want to go to the Jewish scriptures, you know, we have Moses having his religious experience in what we call the burning bush, and within three sentences after his religious experience, we have Yahweh, the God of Israel, telling Moses, go confront the Pharaoh and tell him to let my people go. So you have already in Exodus 3 this marvelous linkage between contemplation and action, if you will, or the inner journey and the outer journey.
There's another interesting spiritual allusion here, too, has been passed to me on occasion, and that is the incident where David wants to build a temple. I think it's in Samuel.
Yeah. And, Samuel.
And
yes.
The prophet Nathan comes to him and said, no, look, I'm doing perfectly well out here with the people, thank you, says God. I've got this tent and I move around with people. And there's a definite message there. And some translations of John have that wonderful phrase, and he pitched his tent among us. Mm-hmm. Which seem to indicate that we do have this problem with buildings as distinct from communities.
Yeah, we've jokingly spoken of the edifice complex, that for some reason we become very preoccupied with confusing and building of physical buildings with the really building of the spiritual church, the building up of the people of God. It's been a common error. I think the male in particular is inclined toward building temples, building edifices. They stand there maybe as a monument to ourselves sometimes, more than God. As a Franciscan, we always had a holy mistrust. Francis told us never to build big churches. If you've been to Assisi, apparently you have, you see there's these two tiny little rebuilt churches still outside the walls of Assisi. And those became the image of what we were to do. A kind of mistrust of ownership, property, land, because already in the 13th century, he realized once you own it, once you build it, you have to spend the rest of your life maintaining it. And you get into church as maintenance instead of church with the kind of freshness and freedom that I think Jesus invited us into and Francis tried to live.
Richard Rohr, much of the current debate in Christian circles about faith and life seems to boil down to a church version of the culture wars, conservative versus liberal. It's as much a distraction as almost anything else one could contemplate in take us away from the sorts of concerns that you say should be central.
Boy, you're putting it very well. I couldn't agree more that we who think we're countercultural and representing an alternative consciousness, at least in our country, I can't speak for Australia, but largely the liberal conservative divide in the churches seems to much more be enmeshed with, as you put it, the culture wars of America. And people who call themselves conservative Catholics, it's not really apparent that they stand for the real enduring Catholic tradition as much as very recent issues that were never the litmus test, for example, of whether you were a Christian. We got by 2,000 years without gay marriage and abortion being the litmus tests of whether you're a Christian. I mean, where did this come from? And I'm not making a stand on these. That's not my point. But I use it as an example of how we're far more trapped in the culture wars of America or Australia than really any deep returning to the message of Jesus, who, in this case, he doesn't talk about homosexuality or abortion ever. So if it had been as central as we make it today, you would think Jesus would have talked about it at least once.
He may not have talked about it, but for you, an aspect of this debate has become a central concern. And I guess it's become a central concern because of the impact that such issues have had in society. You've taken a particular interest over the last few years in men's spirituality. There's a sense in which one facet of this has to be played out in reaction to the social progress of women over the last half century. Certainly the revolution incurred by the pill and the revolution in women's rights, the whole gender roles have shifted quite radically in society. So there is a sense in which aspects of culture do have to bear in on our faith,
absolutely.
It's something that you've seen as critically important.
I wouldn't want to say that we don't want to do that. I would hope the men's work that I'm teaching and representing is not in reaction to. For example, I largely agree with the feminist critique of patriarchy, but my assumption would be that masculinity does not equal patriarchy, which is an abusive power. But for me, it's finding your true spiritual power, your inner power, which critiques the outer abuse of power, if you will. So I hope we're not in any way reactionary, but partnering the women's movement in raising up men who can deal with these issues that women have raised in a healthy, responsive way, but also not roll over and play dead, because we're convinced that the male psyche, the male soul, the male journey, what I call male spirituality, has much to offer the world once we accept that critique of patriarchy.
It did get a pretty bad press over much of the last 30 years, though. There was a sense in which what had to be got rid of was the male approach to things. And that was something that spread generally through corporate psychology, through other things, the feminization of culture. These were seen as necessarily good things, and you could see it in the reaction of even in discussion, the way in which discussions were held. It was seen to be, well, we need a little bit more of the feminine here. The way those discussions were held in many cases did seem to be structured in a right versus wrong paradigm.
Yeah, rather moralistic and righteous, especially in the early years of feminism. It was dualistic thinking at its worst in many ways. My primary teaching after Scripture is teaching the contemplative mind. And for me, the contemplative mind is descriptively given as non-dual reading of reality, where you see things both and not either or.
It's a whole problem with walls, really, isn't it? You set up walls to make distinctives, and those distinctives can be used in either a positive or a negative fashion.
Or a negative fashion.
Well, let's talk about the ways in which this debate has moved from that sort of negative, confrontational dimension to a more positive, integrative role. What are the principles you lay out in working through these issues?
Well, you know, I don't want to start by merely differentiating, but it might actually help. The men's movement that got so panned in the late 80s, early 90s, was in our country associated with Robert Bly, the poet from Minnesota. I actually was just on stage with him a couple months ago, where we sat in a huge auditorium in Minneapolis and just talked, and people came to listen to the two of us talking for some reason.
And you weren't dancing naked around a campfire at the time.
Yeah. But, at that point, people, I don't know, it just became the creating of some straw men and shooting them down. Frankly, I think a lot of it came from a fear in a lot of men as they became aware of how little male friendship they had in their life, how little awareness of spirituality they had in their life. And so anything that was telling them, we've got some work to do, it seems to me that they had to make fun of without even knowing what they were talking about. And this happened to me a number of times, even on radio interviews and BBC in London.
Oh, really? Can I make life unpleasant for you?
And
you're offering a challenge.
They just felt up front they had to dismiss it and put it down. So it's like, where is this fear coming from that you've got to dismiss something that it's obvious you know nothing about? Then, upon the heels of the Robert Bly early stage Iron John movement, developed in America, the Promise Keepers. I don't know if they made their way over here.
We did hear about them.
Yeah. And this was reactionary, in my opinion. It was very right-wing Christian, evangelical beginnings, and everything was to reassert male leadership, male headship in the family.
Well, there are certain aspects of the church in Australia who like to hear that stuff.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure. You know, what I'm talking about is partnership, not domination. That's back into patriarchy at its worst. And it's done too much damage in history to deserve justification. But the male is afraid of true partnership with the woman. He would prefer to maintain a kind of superiority in which, frankly, if both parties accept it, both lose. He remains emotionally immature, and she remains a little girl and not a peer or a partner that I think a true man really wants. So anyway, that did a second whammy on the men's movement. Now we have, I think you have in your country, what we call the Mankind Project, the New Warrior Training. Are you familiar with those words?
Not widely yet.
No. Okay. It might not be as big over here. I addressed their elders in Portland, Oregon last September. And gosh, they're bright. They're successful. They're doing shadow work with themselves and truth speaking. And it's some rugged, honest male stuff. Probably coming a lot more out of the therapeutic, psychological self-help movement, you know. So they're doing good stuff. I wouldn't want to criticize them. But I'm coming, of course, from a spirituality background, and I found out, as good as they are, the G word in that circle is unspeakable. And what I mean, of course, is the God word. Hmm. You can't talk about God. I think in America we've seen religion so misused and so toxic and so unhealthy in so many settings that a lot of people, for understandable reasons, have blocked utterly, as we see in your country, blocked all religiosity.
Well, but one of the reasons, surely, is that mainstream religions, whether it be Protestant or Catholic or even Judaism and Islam, the Abrahamic religions, still have a strand, an extraordinarily powerful strand, that rests on the superiority of male spirituality, dominant male position. Yeah. Now, whether or not Jesus challenged that is the subject of much debate, as is Paul's aspect, but that thread is still seen as a strand which is constantly resurgent. It never goes away.
Oh, yeah. Now, I wouldn't call it male spirituality, though. I'd call it patriarchy. And the monotheistic religions very much align themselves with a patriarchal worldview. Even though I see Jesus, you know, there's no way you can make Jesus into a macho Western man. He's like a man in a male body with an utterly feminine soul. He's nurturing, he touches, he's sensitive, he's warm, he's forgiving. This is not a patriarch. So just by his lifestyle, I think Jesus is clearly undercutting patriarchy, but that's the way I see it.
You're on Sunday Night. Our guest is Richard Rohr, Father Richard Rohr, Franciscan priest, founding director of the Centre for Action and Contemplation, and in Australia to talk about men's spirituality, among many other things. Richard, the issue of men and the church, which we're talking of before we spoke of the music of Leonard Cohen there, is one that cannot easily be dealt with because it involves so many facets of the church, and it's an issue that goes back a long way and sort of part of the digging around. I was surprised to find that actually attempts to re-engage men with religion had been an active part of the Protestant tradition for a good part of the 19th century and into the 20th century. Indeed, a number of the people who went down on the Titanic were evidently delegates to a conference on men and religion to be held in the United States in 1912. There's a balance, just talking about the church at the moment. This is a continuing balance about how you get blokes into the pews and then how you get them active in the church, which is a legitimate debate, isn't it? Because male spirituality or men's roles are often not conducive. The way blokes want to do things are quite often almost seem to be not sympathetic with a sort of reflective, sitting, contemplating. Right. Yeah, blokes want to get up and do things, Give me a building to put up or give me something else I can do. Don't let me sitting around sort of contemplating my navel.
Yeah, if it's true that the feminine psyche is more relational and the male psyche is more agentic, it likes to experience itself as an agent, moving things around. I mean, just watch a little boy. We want to see things move fast or topple over or change other things. You're certainly right. We, for example, have bought 300 acres west of Albuquerque in New Mexico. It's a beautiful piece of land called Red Mesa. And we're now having work camps where the men can come and build our own adobe bricks, which is what we use in New Mexico, to build our little conference center there, to chart a trail from the bottom of the mesa to the top. And you just have no trouble getting men, fathers, sons, if they can do something hands-on. And then for every day of work, I give them half a day of teaching on the Desert Fathers and some guided meditation as they walk through our beautiful countryside, which is desert, but beautiful desert. And I'm just affirming the point you just made, that if it's sitting and singing songs and attending lectures, you just lose 9/10 of men. That isn't the male psyche. And in fact, the men who do want to do it tend to be the kind that you don't want. They're not change agents. They're not people working for social change or for the poor. They're just people who like to sit around and talk about ideas and prove that they're right and other people are wrong. This religion as sermon, as lecture, as the tossing around of ideas that you believe or disbelieve, has not served Christianity very well.
There's also how to fit the difficult question of aggression. Aggression being an identifiable, sort of identified male characteristic, whether it is or not.
Yeah, what do you do with all this testosterone?
And testosterone is a positive as well as a negative. Yeah, it's as much a positive. So where do you go with that building a church? Where do you go with that? Where do you go with that in a spiritual journey?
Well, it just becomes angry, opinionated religious people, which we've seen far too much of, far too long. If all that aggression simply goes into the meticulously addressing, discussing ideas, you see. I love to use the line from John's Gospel, the Word became flesh. And the movement of Jesus from Word to flesh, which is into the material world, the physical world, the corporal world, we haven't followed the movement of Jesus. We've gone back into the Word. For us, the flesh became words again. And there we've argued now for 500 years since the Reformation, not really doing very much to transform Western civilization or to save the planet, in our case.
What you're suggesting is that one of the key ways back is your offer of religion as a lifestyle, that offers practical engagement.
Yeah, right. A practical engagement, that hands-on world that the male understands. For example, Habitat for Humanity, which you've probably heard of, which
yes, indeed.
is rebuilding the homes of the poor all over our country. They have no trouble getting men to volunteer days and weeks of their life to rebuild the houses of the poor. And that was started by Millard Fuller, a man from Koinonia Community in Georgia, beautiful religious motivation. And he's appealed to men with religious motivation, men who don't have religious motivation necessarily, but they sure want to do something to help the next generation.
Richard Rohr, we're rapidly running out of time here. You've been more than generous with us.
Well, I'm enjoying it.
Well, if we had two or three key points which you'd want to leave with our listeners about this broad question of spirituality, the integration of men and women, what would you say?
I guess I made my major point that I believe I'm concerned about raising up men who can be partners, equals, spiritually, relationally to the women of the world, both loving them, but also bringing appropriate male challenge to some issues that I think honestly have been over-feminized, that they're not necessarily a healthy balance, but where the male psyche, the male soul has something to offer are our sisters too. And in a certain sense, it's been understandably, but a one-way conversation that feminism was here for the last 20 years to totally critique patriarchy, and I'm glad it did. But I think healthy males, which as I said, is different than patriarchy, I think it has something to say to an overly soft and self-serving world that is sometimes called femininity, and I don't think it is, but I look at some church groups. Let me just give you an example where the feminine energy has totally taken over, and everything is about making one another feel good. It feels like affirmation, flattering one another with how wonderful we are and how right we are, and you shouldn't suffer and you shouldn't work too hard and don't tax yourself. You take care of yourself. I don't know. After a while, that becomes so cloying, and you lose any sense of a bigger world and the real pain in this world and the real social responsibility we have to this world beyond flattering one another's feelings.
And to expose ourselves to pain, in a sense.
Yeah. And when I started the male initiation rites, that's what the young male was taught, that life is hard. And there's a lot of pain out there, and you have to learn how to move into it so that you can empathize, sympathize with other people's pain, and not just slough it off or move it into a small circle of people who scratch one another's back about how hard they've had it, when very often they haven't had it hard at all. So much of the feminist movement in our country came from upper-middle-class women, not the womanist movement, for example, which was women of color, women who've been marginalized, lesbian women, who have a whole different perspective to bring that very often, in my opinion, is much closer to what we're saying in masculine spirituality.
Richard Rohr, the one question I haven't asked you is about the link you make in the title of your center between action and contemplation. I've alluded to it. But there is a deep link that people find paradoxical. If you contemplate
yes.
and you be, yeah. you can't possibly do.
Do. Yeah. And, of course, that's because of our normal understanding of the word contemplation, which does look very passive. For me, contemplation, and I can prove this from the whole older tradition, is a different form of consciousness. It's not being introverted. It's not being pious. It's looking out at life in what would best be described as a non-dual mind, where you do not divide between either or. You don't eliminate the problematic, the negative, the mysterious, the difficult. You hold the field of the moment open, and you let the moment come to you as it is, without categorizing it up or down, in or out, Catholic, Protestant, black, white, gay, straight, right, wrong. You simply receive a person or a moment or an event as it is without labeling it. If I could do nothing more than reintroduce the ancient tradition of contemplation to Western Christianity, I believe it is this mindset that will allow us to create a much fresher politics and a much more congenial theological dialogue within ourselves and between ourselves. So contemplation is really, if I do nothing else, I'd just love to teach that, because that really changes people.
Final question, Richard Rohr. The last 30 years have seen us move through technological innovation into a profound change in the very nature of the structure of relationships, and particularly in gender relationships, as we've touched on.
That's
the
right.
Church is having great difficulty accommodating itself to these.
Mm-hmm.
Is the church eventually going to have to move? Some of those walls, it's a bit like Paul in Ephesians back there talking about the circumcised and the uncircumcised. So, those big sort of defining elements of what it was to be one of the faithful, are those boundaries going to have to shift?
You know, this phenomenon that I described as the emerging church is emerging precisely because of that. That as the historic churches, my Catholic Church in particular, is circling the wagons of defensiveness and really paranoia, because it doesn't know how to talk to the feminine world, the world outside of itself. It has to bring everybody in to use our vocabulary before we can talk to you. That smaller and smaller venue is simply inadequate to the task. So I think you're going to see the emerging church, which is not anti-church, it's not a church, it's parallel to church, where you draw upon the good things that the tradition has offered us, and much of it is brilliant and good, but much of it is missing the point and incapable of dialoguing with the pain of the world, with anybody who's perceived as an outsider. I mean, Jesus told us to preach the gospel to all nations, but what it amounts to is we can talk to you if you agree, if you let us decide the boundaries and the vocabulary. In other words, come and join us, and then we can talk to you. This is not preaching the gospel to all the nations. Do you understand? And our institutional structures seem to disallow this larger conversation.
Richard Rohr, it's been great to speak with you this evening. I haven't even touched on the male priesthood, but there you go.
That's probably just as good. Last time, or several times ago when I was here, the Archbishop or Bishop of Perth called me in to say, "You are not allowed to talk about women in the priesthood."
Well, yeah, we haven't transgressed, but we get the picture. Richard Rohr, fabulous to have you with us. Let's finish with another piece of Leonard Cohen. This, The Anthem.